Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, the show where we cross the lines of the political spectrum to take on all the complicated issues. I'm your host this week, Moa Lathy, filling in for David Green. As always, I'm joined by Sarah Isker, senior editor at The Dispatch, a lawyer and former spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Well, guys, good news. The government might be saved, at least for now. With a shutdown hanging in the balance, Congress voted to pass a spending measure that would keep the government open beyond this weekend's deadline, at least for a few more months. It was a trial by fire for the newly elected Speaker of the House, Louisiana Representative Mike Johnson. The measure's a stopgap bill with split deadlines that keep some government agencies open until January and others open until February at current spending levels. Now, while the Speaker's approach was certainly novel, it was very much like the legislation passed by former Speaker Kevin McCarthy in one important way. It passed with more support from Democrats than from Republicans, which was the very sin that was the catalyst for McCarthy's ouster as Speaker. In fact, more than 90 House Republicans voted against the measure, upset that it didn't include any spending cuts. Confused? Me too. So we're very lucky to have the perfect person to help us make sense of it all. Jackie Kucinich is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Welcome to the show, Jackie.
Thanks for having me. I will try to live up to that very kind introduction.
Well, Jackie, maybe you can help explain to us what just happened. How did we get to this point with this staggered deadline thing, and how is that going to work?
So we got to this point because, I mean, the Republicans couldn't decide on a path forward. So they had to, you know, rope in the Democrats to get this over the line and keep the government funded. And you're right to point out that that's exactly what Kevin McCarthy did when it came to the debt ceiling, and it cost him his job. But in this case, Speaker Johnson seems to have had enough goodwill built up with his right wing that they're not threatening to oust him. However, they're not making it terribly comfortable for him. Right after this bill passed, you had a rule go down, which is what happens when people, usually the party in power, their party will get behind the rule that sets up debate. Sorry to get into the weeds right away. But so when someone from the Republican Party votes against a Republican rule, it's not a nice thing to do to your party. And so they've made their displeasure known. And I just don't know if turkey and pie or whatever they have for their Thanksgivings is going to really fix all of the hurt feelings and just general discomfort that's going on with the House Republicans right now.
Yeah, I mean, the Speaker all but said that members of the House are living in a pressure cooker right now, and it would do them all good to leave town for the holiday. But I'm with you. Like, is it really going to get any better? What was it this time? Why was he able to get this done when McCarthy wasn't? Was it just because he's the new guy and they wanted to cut him some slack, or is there something else going on there?
I think that is a part of it. And also, I think that he knew that Democrats would vote for it, and they couldn't get to, there wasn't anything that they could get their party all around. They couldn't decide on a way forward that all the Republicans could agree on. And let's not forget, it's not just the conservatives that we're talking about here. We're also talking about moderate members from those 18 districts that Biden won, who want to have something to be, you know, reelected on. This isn't it. But this gets them close. This stops the chaos. And as you rightly pointed out, gets them out of town. They've been here for 10 weeks, which in the real world is called life, when you have to work for 10 weeks straight. But Congress being in Washington for 10 weeks is not a recipe for success, as we've seen. It's just been constant chaos since October.
So Senate Democrats didn't like this. They thought the whole staggered thing was kind of weird and wonky. And it didn't include the $106 billion in national security funding that was requested, nothing to help out Ukraine or Israel. Is that something they think they can get down the road? Or is that going to continue to be a sticking point in DOA?
So in terms of the Ukraine funding, it's going to be a really hard thing to get across the line in the House. There's just a lot of House Republicans who are against increasing funding for or continuing to fund the war between Ukraine and Russia. I don't think that anyone knows yet, Mo, to be honest with you. It feels like we're going to be in a doom loop till at least Groundhog Day, which is when the second tranche of spending runs out in this tiered system that Speaker Johnson passed. It's actually on Groundhog Day, which is just like you can't. If someone wrote this script, you'd be like, come on. But we're just going to continue to be in this doom loop until until next year, at least.
Yeah, Sarah, I want to play for you a clip of House Republican Chip Roy of Texas speaking on the floor in advance of the vote about the lack of spending cuts in the plan. Let's play that clip.
And we're pissing it away. We're giving it away. All that they fought for, all of those freedoms, we are giving it away. Why? Because we're too cowardly to stand up and do our job. Oh, no, a shutdown. Are you freaking kidding me? Oh, we can't have a shutdown heading into Thanksgiving. What will they say or do? How about we stand up and fight and go to the American people and tell them that we believe we should be doing what they sent us here to do?
Chip Roy's not one to mince his words, is he?
So, you know, what's funny, Mo, is I know Chip well. We worked together on the 2002 Cornyn race, his first race for Senate. And I sat next to Chip Roy. He was the policy director for that race. So I've known Chip basically my whole adult life. That is genuinely angry Chip, I can tell you from the voice.
So what do they do? Yeah. How do they get through this? If that's where House Republicans, if that's where the base is, the base that helped get Mike Johnson, the speaker's chair, if that's what they're feeling, like, how do we avoid this again?
We don't. Is that a real question?
okay, then.
Look, there's another part of what Chip says in that speech that I actually found more interesting when you want to dive into it, which is he said, name one thing that Republicans can run on, name one accomplishment from having the majority of the House that we can tell our constituents we did this year. It's like, we can't name one. First of all, I'm happy that anyone in Congress sees that as a problem, because part of my concern has been that, in fact, that's not a problem for many people. Chip Roy's a little unique in that regard. As part of that caucus, he is the nerd of the caucus, if you will. Like, he's in the policy weeds. But I was also curious to ask Jackie, you know, a part of this we haven't talked about. You mentioned that they had, God forbid, been at work for 10 weeks in a row. We also saw just a lot of, I mean, it's silliness on the one hand. I'll let you characterize it. Wannabe fisticuffs happening on the Hill this week between various men. And I couldn't help but wonder, when you're no longer running on legislative accomplishments, when no one thinks you're going to have legislative accomplishments, of course it turns into kind of this like real world Capitol Hill show where he punched me in the kidney. No, I didn't. Stand up and fight, you P word, et cetera. Like, this is all now just performative. And so they're performing.
I mean, yeah, real Charles Sumner energy on the Hill.
At least
this
that
week.
Was over something though.
Right. Fair. You have a point. The frustration, I've never seen a Republican conference this divided. I've seen some fights in the past. This one, they cannot get out of their own way. Now, listen, if you are the majority party and the president is not from your party, there's going to be some friction, and you don't want to get they don't want to pass the Biden agenda. That's not why they're there. But at least in the past, when you had that sort of divided government, you saw bills go through that, you know, they had a purpose, they had a message. And, you know, say what you will about messaging bills, but that's just kind of how the House works when they don't share the presidency with in their party. they haven't even done that because they've spent so much time fighting amongst themselves. And that doesn't look, and in part, it's because they had this, they have this narrow majority, but you know who else had a narrow majority? Nancy Pelosi. And she still managed to get stuff passed. Or through her very divided caucus. So it really, whether or not they can resolve their differences, I mean, we had a reporter talking to members yesterday, didn't seem like anything was going, Thanksgiving was really going to help and mend any wounds. We'll have to see if they can get any appropriations bills off the House floor. They haven't seemed to be able to do that. And in the midst of it all, you know, you have the speaker who doesn't have any real experience in House leadership, which does matter because you realize, you know, how complicated it is, who's learning on the job. So it really is just a, we'll just say a turducken of issues for the Republican conference. Just, you know, keeping the theme.
I'm just keep coming back to the weirdness of this whole staggered approach and how anybody could think that it's a good idea to set up not just one, but two more deadlines. Like we, you know, anytime we're fighting over, anytime there's a looming deadline, everyone freaks out and Washington and Congress shows its dysfunction. They've just set it up so that they get to do this twice in January and February. And it just, you know, it's funny, you know, in the good old days when one party showed dysfunction, the other party would just sit there and rub their hands together and smile and salivate. But I don't know a whole lot of Democrats in the House right now that are salivating. I mean, they see, I think, the political upside of this for them heading into the elections. But I think everyone is just exhausted. Now we're going to have to go through this twice. Like, that can't be good for the Speaker, for the Republican caucus and or conference, and for all of us.
I think applying logic right now is folly to what is going on in the House of Representatives. But you make a good point that we're going into an election year, a presidential election year. And the fact that they're going to be warring like this, or there's going to be a lot of conflict on the House floor as these primaries are going, I mean, so say what you will about the primaries, but it's not going to, this isn't going to go unnoticed by any stretch of the imagination. And this doesn't, it's not going to make them look good. I mean, you can just hear the record buttons go down when Chip Roy was speaking at the DCCC, because they are just providing so much fodder for the Democratic opposition here. But to your point, I mean, while Democrats have been united on this, there is a lot of frustration that they haven't, that nothing has gotten done this year. And they're still showing up and, you know, but it's still, you're still stuck there. And that's not, you know, that's not, that I don't think that's why a lot of them are there.
Yeah, let's turn our attention to one other interesting thing that happened on the floor of the House or in the House this week. And that was this long-awaited ethics report about George Santos, the congressman from New York, famous for lying about everything.
About
everything. And there'd been an attempt to expel him from Congress a few weeks back that did not pass, with a lot of members saying they were going to wait for this ethics committee report to come out. Well, the report came out this week, and it was about as scathing a report as I've ever seen, basically saying the guy defrauded his voters, his constituents, his donors for personal gain. The ethics committee chairman immediately announced he was going to file a motion to expel George Santos. And Santos went back on his word, saying he would actually step down, or not step down, but not seek re-election in 2024. Jackie, I'm just kind of curious what you're hearing and about all of that. And is this going to alleviate some pressure on some of his Republican colleagues, or make it even tougher?
I think it's twofold here. First of all, I should just mention how remarkable it is that you have the House Ethics Chairman not only weighing in, but filing a motion. Usually on the ethics committee, it's like Fight Club. They don't talk about it. They issue reports. You don't hear a lot of ethics committee members speaking out about investigations that they've been doing. It's just not a thing. So that in and of itself, that he is filing this motion, is remarkable. But if they do, so on one hand, you know, you would think it would help Republicans to be, you know, getting rid of a guy who's very scandal plagued and can't apparently stop being scandal plagued. On the flip side, you're losing a voting Republican member of Congress if you expel him, and that means your majority is even tinier than it was the day before. So it really, I'm interested to see what happens when and if this comes up for a vote, because it truly is going to be remarkable which path they just choose to take.
Sarah, do you think the fact that he announced he's not running for re-election will change the calculus for any of his colleagues and how they might vote?
I don't think so. I think they're obviously going to move to the vote to expel. I think he'll be expelled. Look, one of the lines on here was that he was taking donor money, putting it into his personal checking account, and then spending that money, including, I think, $4,000 at Hermes, but also on OnlyFans, you know, that website. There's just not a lot to hold your, you know, Jackie's right. The only reason not to is that he's one more vote in a very, very narrowly divided Congress. But this guy is an embarrassment. And the longer he's there, the more he embarrasses them.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Jackie Kucinich, Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, thanks for helping us make sense of all the craziness in Congress this week. I'll be back with Sarah Isker to talk about how the conflict in Israel and Gaza is impacting our politics here at home. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Mo Alathy, filling in for David Green this week, here with Sarah Isker as always. This week, we've seen Israel continue its battle with Hamas as it seeks the return of over 200 hostages taken following the brutal terrorist attack of October 7th. Now, there's been strong support from the U.S. government, with President Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken making several trips and statements on behalf of Israel's military efforts. And there's also been widespread, generally, public support in the United States for Israel's efforts, including a large rally earlier this week at the National Mall in Washington. But just days earlier, there was also a large rally in Washington protesting the civilian deaths in Gaza and calling for a ceasefire. And as that civilian death toll in Gaza continues to climb, some are wondering if a growing disconnect between the president and some Democratic voters could cause him some political challenges heading into 2024. A letter this week signed by hundreds of U.S. government officials and staff members called on the president to demand a ceasefire. A new poll from NPR shows most Democrats say Israel has gone too far with its military response. And Democratic officials in Michigan, which has one of the largest Arab American populations in the country, are sounding alarm bells, concerned that the president's decidedly pro-Israel stance could jeopardize the state's electoral votes next year. Well, to help us make sense of this, we're joined now by our special guest, Emily Horn. Emily is a former spokesperson for the National Security Council under President Biden and a member of the State Department under President Obama. Hello, Emily.
Hi, Mo. Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So, Emily, when you look at these polls, you see that there still is overall, putting aside the president's approval rating, just looking at what should be done in the region and Israel's response to it, there's still general public support amongst the American people for Israel, but we are seeing both a partisan and a generational divide there. The overall support is being driven by Republican and independent voters, while Democrats are much more evenly split on whether or not they think Israel's response has been appropriate. And we're also seeing a generational divide with voters under 45 much, much more critical of Israel's response. That's clearly a critical voting block for the president as he moves forward into his reelection campaign. I guess that's sort of the question, right? Like, is this going to be a problem for him within his own base, where his positioning seems to be much more in tune with Republican and independent voters than with at least a significant portion of the Democratic base?
So not to do that thing where we're on a podcast and we cite another podcast, but I would commend Mike Poritz's conversation with Ezra Klein on exactly this topic, on what the difference between polls and voting. I mean, let's just acknowledge we are a year out from the 2024 election, and nobody can say with any real certainty how that election is going to go, other than that it will be close. I think that's a reasonable supposition to make based on the data. But trying to determine via a poll what the outcome of that election is going to be right now is just throwing a dart into the darkness. Nobody knows. But what Mike talks about, and I think this is a really important point, is that there's a big difference between how a voter or a potential voter answers a question in a poll and what they decide when they show up and have to cast a vote on a ballot and are given the choice between candidates. A poll is a way to express frustration. A poll is a way to say, I am not satisfied with what is happening here. I have a problem with what is happening here. But that's a very different frame than what has to happen when a voter shows up, whether it's via absentee or at a polling station, and pulls out that ballot and has to make a choice between candidates. And look, I'm a Democrat, so obviously I have my priors here, but I think you're going to hear Joe Biden and his campaign reminding everyone over the next year that this election is going to be a choice between a MAGA and a non-MAGA view of the United States of America. And let's face it, the candidate is going to be Donald Trump. I think that's, insofar as we can predict these things with certainty, that's a reasonable prediction. And you're going to hear the campaign talking about what a second Trump administration is going to look like for America. You're going to hear Donald Trump talking about what a second Trump administration is going to look like for America. And he makes that case quite clearly. And it's a pretty grim case. It's planning to round up hundreds of thousands of migrants who have been in the U.S. for decades and mass deporting them. He's got his advisors talking about this, essentially saying the quiet part out loud to the New York Times this week. It's going to be reminding people that as a result of Donald Trump and his three Supreme Court justices, we have no longer have Roe v. Wade. And as a result, millions of Americans, women have lost the rights that their mothers and their grandmothers fought for. It's going to be reminding the American people that Trump egged on the insurrectionists who stormed the Capitol on January 6th and that he not just nods at, but literally hugs white nationalists. It's going to be reminding the American people that these are a choice between that MAGA future and a future under a second Biden administration. And that's a very different framework than taking the temperature of what is your approval of the president on this day.
So one of the things, Sarah and I have talked about this ad nauseum over the past few weeks, like one of the things that just frustrates me is how in politics we tend to talk about everything in black and white terms when a lot of times we live in the gray. And that is incredibly, especially true in this. But I feel like we are the political battle lines are more black and white than they ever have been. You know, and I guess what's interesting to me is the president has actually, at least from my perspective, been trying to live in the gray on this by expressing very strong support for Israel, its right to defend itself, going for its right to go after and take out Hamas, but also increasingly taking a measured approach, calling for these humanitarian pauses, not going so far as a ceasefire, as many in his base would like to see, but calling for humanitarian pauses and pressuring Israel to take them by sending strong messages, both publicly and privately, about how Israel needs to be more careful with the civilians on the ground, not targeting Palestinian hospitals, etc. For those people within the Democratic Party, those Arab Americans in Michigan who are desperately calling for a ceasefire, is the president's nuance here going to be enough to satisfy them, to ease their concerns?
It's such an important question, Mo. And you say a really important thing in there, which is that policymaking lives in the gray. And so often, especially national security and foreign policy, you don't have the luxury of a good, clear, right choice that is the obvious winner. You are forced to navigate a series of really challenging circumstances, and you have a lot of bad options. And your challenge as a policymaker and as a leader is to choose the least bad option, explain why it's the least bad option, and do everything you can to make it a better reality based on that bad option. It's really, really, really hard. And I think what you have seen from the administration is a very strong attempt to talk about, one, just the terrible humanity of this conflict, the absolutely catastrophic loss of human life, both amongst Israeli civilians and among Palestinian civilians, and really making clear that every life lost is an utter tragedy. So that is table stakes, but it also cannot be said enough. Now, I think the administration and the president in particular have been very strong and very clear in articulating Israel's right to defend itself and reminding the world that what the attack on October 7th was the worst massacre of Jews since the Holocaust. And Israel does have the right to defend itself, but it also has the obligation to follow international law, to follow the law of war. And part of where the United States can be effective is publicly and privately reminding Israeli leadership of the importance, the paramount importance, not just of following the law, but that following the law helps you win the moral case for your own self-defense. That when you demonstrate that you are taking actions to protect civilian lives, you deny terrorists like Hamas the ability to control the narrative and say, look at what Israel is doing. And speaking from my own experience working in counterterrorism over the years, you know, we went to extraordinary lengths under the Obama administration and also in the Biden administration when we were conducting terrorist operations to take out, whether it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda or other terrorist group leadership, to prevent the loss of civilian life. Careful monitoring, careful operations, lots of explaining after the fact of how we did this and why. And it's painstaking and it's really hard, but it does allow you to make that case that you care about human life much more than the enemy does. That is a case that I think the Israelis would do well to follow more of as they are conducting their operations against Hamas. And importantly, as they are conducting operations to try to free the hostages that are being held by Hamas. Now, I've also done a lot of hostage diplomacy in my time, and I can tell you, this is an extraordinarily sensitive period that the United States government is in, that the Israeli government is in, when there are hundreds of innocent civilians who are being held in a place where we all have very low visibility in a very densely populated urban center, at a place where we know that Hamas has a history of using civilians, of using women and children as human shields. That is an extraordinarily complex terrain in which to be trying to get people out safely, both hostages and also protecting civilian lives. My fervent hope is that when we get our people home, then there will be a good story to tell about how we worked with the Israelis to do that in a way that protected innocent civilians. That is a very difficult story to tell right now at this particular moment, just because of where those operations are and how they're happening and unfolding in real time. Your hands as a government communicator are really tied when something this sensitive is underway. So yes, this is a challenging moment from a messaging perspective. My hope is that they will not always be this way and that we will be able to tell a more fulsome story about all the work that we have been doing behind the scenes to try to protect innocent civilian lives during these operations.
Sarah, let me bring you in. We've talked a lot about growing cases of anti-Semitism across the country. There are growing cases of Islamophobia happening across the country. You've got people accusing the Biden administration of participating in a quote-unquote genocide. You've also got Republican members of the House who are floating proposals to kick Palestinian Americans out of the country and Donald Trump resurfacing his old Muslim ban. Like, what are your thoughts on the politics of all this and how it's going to play out heading into 24?
You know, Mo, I'm going to quote someone who I think you like a lot. Mo. This is really, I think, highlighted your... This has turned in far less left versus right and much more top versus bottom, in the sense that, you know, you've got Hillary Clinton sounding a whole lot like Kevin McCarthy, sounding a whole lot like, you know, the people who actually have experience, frankly, in dealing with this problem. I mean, I thought Hillary Clinton's op-ed in The Atlantic was spot on. There was a ceasefire in place on October 6th. Hamas violated it. There was a ceasefire in place over and over again. Israel has agreed to ceasefires. And over again, Hamas violates it. Ceasefires don't end conflicts. They freeze them. And they just simmer there until someone breaks. And time again, it's been Hamas breaking. We simply don't expect any other country to tolerate rockets being launched at them every day, except Israel. We do expect Israel to do that because that's what was happening in advance of October 7th. And I'm using top and bottom here, you know, not for any particular reason. But so you've got, you know, top Democrats and top Republicans all agreeing on those points. But then you've also got, I don't know what else to call them other than the anti-Semitic left, totally agreeing with the white supremacist right and increasingly the populist right, the Tucker Carlsons, the Steve Bannons, who are just like, not our problem. I mean, Tucker Carlson making the point this week that he wasn't sure why everyone got so emotional about this foreign tragedy. You know, it's not like it was Americans, although footnote, it literally was Americans. Many Americans were killed on October 7th, and we know that at least a dozen Americans are being held hostage. That part I find really fascinating as we're talking about this realignment, as we're watching the Biden reelection campaign lose altitude, at least, with Democratic voters overall. I mean, Republicans at this point, much happier, according to polling, with their choices than Democrats are with their choices. But overall, the Democratic Party losing altitude with Black and brown voters. And Mo, you've diagnosed this over and over again, that it's not right versus left. It's something else going on. And as that realignment happens, we're going to watch weird bedfellows in real time where you have a lot of Republicans cheering on Hillary Clinton and a lot of Democrats cheering on Tucker Carlson.
Sarah, that is such an important point. And if I can add to that, I don't think that this is a uniquely American phenomenon. David Brooks had a really good piece out this week in the New York Times, talking about how so many of Biden's fellow G7 and G20 leaders in places where there are Democratic elections are experiencing similar drops in public opinion. From France to Japan to the United Kingdom, I mean, there is something in the water that people are not satisfied with the status quo. And they are expressing it in polling that shows up as disapproval of their own elected leadership. And that's really been consistent across the G20 nations that have democratically elected governments. I'm really fascinated by that. And I think that there's something, you know, that there's a common DNA there with your description of up and down or top and bottom that I'd be curious to unpack more.
I could listen to Sarah quote me all day long, but unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Emily Horn is a former spokesperson for the National Security Council under President Biden. Emily, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mo. Thanks, Sarah.
Sarah and I will be back with an alternative solution for your Thanksgiving table that could have a big impact on climate change. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can it's at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Mo Alethi, filling in for David Green. We're here with Sarah Isger, as always, senior editor at The Dispatch. And Sarah, I'm going to toss it to you because this next segment is something you've been pretty excited to talk about.
Mo, I have been pitching this segment for months. I am very excited. Thanksgiving is right around the corner. Families across the country are preparing for several days of food and football. Sweet potatoes, cranberries, green beans are flying off the shelves. And of course, turkey. It's the primary protein of the holiday season. About 46 million turkeys are consumed during the season. My family will account for 2 of them here in my house and 3 of them at my cousin's house that we also usually go to. It's a small representation of the scale of meat production. It's an industry that is often underestimated when considering contributors to global climate change, which is surprising because even if we were to eliminate the effects of fossil fuel, global agriculture emissions would still have the U.S. falling well short of the Paris Climate Accord goals, for instance. One way to mitigate that impact is alternative proteins, food that resembles the taste, texture, and nutritional value of meats, eggs, and dairy products, but are plant-based or lab-made. Joining us to discuss those proteins and the role they can play in the future of our planet is Bruce Friedrich. Bruce is president and founder of the Good Food Institute, a global science think tank focused on alternative proteins. Bruce, welcome to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks so much, Sarah. I am beyond thrilled to be here. I love this podcast.
Bruce and I have been friends now for a while because while I may be the right of this podcast, and you may make assumptions about what that means to be right of center or a conservative, I am a crunchy con to the extreme. I love tofu. I also love animals. And as I've been talking to Bruce, my obsession has become lab-made meat. And Bruce, I want you to describe this, but in short, this is real meat cells. It just doesn't come from a dead animal.
That's basically right. Well, that's absolutely right. And I will say it's a bipartisan effort. We call it cultivated meat rather than lab grown. Most meat sciences departments around the country are using conventional meat. So they're working in meat labs. Cultivated meat also starts in a meat lab, but the vast majority of lab grown meat is just conventional meat. And basically what it entails is taking, so just like you can take a seed from a plant or a cutting from a plant, and bathe the seed or the cutting in nutrients, and that will grow into an entire plant. You can take a small sampling of cells from a chicken or a pig or a cow or a fish, bathe those cells in nutrients and grow actual animal meat. But you don't need antibiotics. About 70% of medically relevant antibiotics right now are fed to farm animals. You can eliminate that. Requires a fraction of the land, causes a fraction of the direct emissions, and has a bunch of other benefits as well. And support for this is bipartisan. Donald Trump's Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, and Donald Trump's FDA Commissioner, Scott Gottlieb, were very enthusiastic about alternative proteins. There's a report for this from the Center for Strategic and International Studies that's talking about the importance of the United States leaning in on this technology for food security and national security reasons. So, it's just a different way of making meat that's a lot less resource intensive, basically.
I want to get to the politics of this, but just for people who are curious, we're not talking about like growing filet mignon in a petri dish yet.
We're never going to be growing anything in a petri dish, or it's going to be, you know, way too expensive to be viable. So we're talking about basically in the same way that you brew beer in a fermenter, you can grow meat in cultivators. And because there are not live animals involved, it's the exact same end product, but huge food safety benefits, no medically relevant antibiotics required, just a cleaner, safer way of making meat. And all of the biggest meat companies in the world are investing in startups or doing their own cultivated meat endeavors. As well as ADM is on the front lines of this. And it is bipartisan. Some McKinsey modeling said that by 2050, alternative proteins, both plant-based meat and cultivated meat, could add $700 billion to the global economy and create 83 million jobs. So that's why the CSIS report really leans into the various climate, food security, and global health benefits. But also leans in on economic competitiveness. And that's the thing that Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue under Donald Trump, and Scott Gottlieb, the FDA commissioner, those were the things they were focused on.
And this is where I think the politics do become very interesting, because if you're someone who cares about climate change, believes in man-made climate change, there can still be a lot of disagreement. I would argue the heart of the disagreement between the right and the left is over what to do about that, because the U.S. acting alone really can't fix the planet. You have China, for instance, with a huge population, much, of course, larger than the United States, that maybe is less interested in taking steps to prevent climate change while they're growing their economy. So hurting the U.S. economy and then letting China grow theirs doesn't make a lot of sense. But on the right, at least, the theory has always been there need to be technological breakthroughs in order to fix climate change, not regulatory efforts by the government. That's where this becomes super interesting, because it is a huge technological breakthrough where people don't feel like they're just being told you have to sacrifice your jobs or the economy or your standard of living. But in fact, it will still be a choice.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have to globally produce something on the order of twice as much meat by 2050. The predictions vary, but the lowest prediction is 62% more meat. And we've been making meat in the same way for 12,000 years, growing crops to feed them to animals so that we can eat animals. The most efficient animal at turning soy and other crops into meat is the chicken. According to the World Resources Institute, it takes 9 calories into a chicken to get 1 calorie back out. That's literally 800% food waste. So it's 9 times as much land, 9 times as much water, 9 times the pesticides and herbicides, et cetera. If we can figure out on the plant-based side, and plant-based meat, the idea of plant-based meat is simply that animal-based meat is made up of fats, proteins, minerals, and water. Plants also have fats, proteins, minerals, and water. If we can give consumers the exact same meat experience using plants by solving these science challenges and scaling up, it should be significantly less expensive. That's also the theory of cultivated meat, except there you're talking about actual animal meat. And this is the one climate intervention on the food system that has to do with this, you know, twice as much meat in 2050, 700 million metric tons of land animal meat in 2050 is the expectation. As that happens, just like over time, energy consumption is going to go up, and we should encourage energy efficient light bulbs, energy efficient buildings, but we need renewable energy. And just like the number of passenger vehicles sold and miles driven is going to go up through 2050 as we have more people and populations develop. And so, sure, we should have walkable cities and great public transport and all of it, but we need EVs. Same thing here. So education about the external costs of the meat industry is great. But at the end of the day, in the last 27 years to 2050, in the last 27 years, meat production and consumption is up 80%. Something like that is going to happen through 2050, and that is going to blow past Paris goals and also be horrible for biodiversity and global health. So we need to come up with an intervention, and making meat from plants, cultivating meat from cells, that is a pretty, we think, appealing intervention.
And Mo, I want to bring you in here, but you know, the other part of this that is politically fascinating to me is you want to talk about national security and global wars that we're dealing with and unrest. Do you know what will at least help that? Is not having any more hungry people on the planet. And this is at least a way to move that forward, because as you said, meat's expensive. I don't know. What's your take, Mo?
Well, no, I've got a question for Bruce, right? Because I think one of the challenges we've seen in efforts to tackle climate change is that a lot of times it requires a fundamental shift in human behavior, right? We're asking people to do something differently than they have before. And for it to have an impact, that's got to happen at scale. This seems to me, I'm just kind of curious your thoughts on how do we get people to think differently about the meat that they consume? And can we get enough of them to do so that it has a real impact?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the great things about making meat from plants and cultivating meat from cells, Mo, is that it plugs directly into the question you're asking. And just like when you turn on the lights, you know, you want them to go on. And for most people, they're not going to pay more for solar or wind or other renewable energy. But they're also not going to pay, you know, more for fossil fuels. They just want the lights to come on. Or if you're, you know, going to buy a car, most people are not going to pay more for an electric vehicle. Most people are not going to satisfy are not going to be satisfied with a 85-mile range in their EV. Most people don't want to wait around for hours or drive around for hours looking for charging infrastructure. So you need to give consumers what they love about driving, what the, you know, what they love about powering their lives through energy production. And here with meat, the central sort of observation of alternative proteins is that we're not going to change consumer behavior. Even in the United States, the five highest years for per capita meat consumption are the most recent five. We've been trying to convince people to change their diets for at least the last 27 years, and it's up 80%. Unless we have some new intervention that we think is going to suddenly change human nature, we need to try something different. And that's where alternative proteins comes in. The entire idea is to meet consumers where they are and to make meat from plants that is indistinguishable. And as it scales up, because it is so much more efficient, it can win on price. Or with cultivated meat, it's literally the exact same thing. And as it scales up, it can be less expensive. And we can give people the meat that they love, but made in a better way, requiring a fraction of the land, causing a fraction of the climate change, not requiring medically relevant drugs, et cetera.
Bruce, thank you so much for joining us. And as people are thinking about their turkey alternatives this year, is cultivated meat an option?
Not on turkey. So the two countries that have approved cultivated meat for sale at this point, one of them is Singapore. They did it about 3 years ago. The other is the United States. But so far, it's just Jose Andres's restaurant in Washington, D.C., China Chilcano. And it's chicken. And then Dominique Kren's restaurant in San Francisco, which is also chicken. So far, we just have chicken. But it's early days. And the GFI's sort of global battle cry and what CSIS calls for in the CSIS report, they say the U.S. government should prioritize alternative proteins in the same way it prioritizes the U.S. pharma industry, the clean energy industry, and advanced chips for artificial intelligence. For the reasons that you flagged, Sarah, that it's a global food security is national security and for economic competitiveness reasons.
Well, look, it's chicken and I bet it tastes like chicken, like all chicken and things that aren't chicken taste like. So thank you, yeah, Bruce.
It's and, simultaneously groundbreaking and mundane. Sorry.
That's what I love to hear. Groundbreaking and mundane is what I specialize in. Bruce Friedrich from the Good Food Institute, thanks for joining.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants and raves featuring pet peeves and projects from across the political spectrum. And I've got such a big rant, I'm going to do it this week. Sarah, you can have yours next week. But as we head into Thanksgiving, it's a time when people come together, sit around the table, and talk about things. Oftentimes politics, and oftentimes it's not a lot of fun. I get students all the time asking me how they can talk to their family members about politics. My number one answer this year is going to be watch Congress and do the exact opposite. Our Congress is not putting its best foot forward in how it deals with one another. And we talked about this a little bit earlier in the show, but just look at this last week where we had former Speaker Kevin McCarthy accused of kidney punching a political rival within his own party, where Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene called another Republican member a part of the female anatomy for disagreeing with her, where Senator Markwayne Mullen of Oklahoma, a former mixed martial artist, challenged the president of the Teamsters Union to a fight, physical fight, in a Senate committee chamber. Let me put this in language that these folks might understand. Grow the hell up. Our country is dealing with major issues, and we have seen what happens in these polarized times when our rhetoric gets the better of us and can lead to very real consequences. It's time for our Congress to grow up. It's time for our Congress to deal with these real issues. Stop the schoolyard bickering and get to work. Happy Thanksgiving. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Sarah Isker and to our guests, Jackie Kucinich, Emily Horn, and Bruce Friedrich. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark A. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded and mixed by Nick Lamponi. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. We're distributed by PRX. I'm Moa Lathy. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.